Welcome to the Comedy Store Podcast. We're just waxing about Tab and other fine 80s diet sodas, Pepsi Free, all the good stuff from back in the day.
Jolt Cola.
Jolt was the bomb. And I didn't find out till mid-90s, but there was multiple flavors of Jolt.
There was?
Yeah, they had like grape and orange and a couple other ones. I found them at a truck stop in like Eastern Colorado one time at a Rip Griffin's truck stop. I was like, look at all the flavors of Jolt.
That's weird. Got I only remember up. The one, and it really reminds me of Robin Williams, the can, and I don't like Mork and Mindy.
Right.
It has nothing to do with it, but it just feels like Mork when I look at Jolt Cola. It's like a, you know, nanu nanu Jolt, you know?
He probably he had to be on something similar to Jolt. I mean, it might have been more cocaine induced, but yeah, his energy level was as if he were doing just straight thunder bumps of Jolt Cola as long as he could.
It's weird because when I did coke, I was never like, hey, man,
No.
It's the opposite for me. I think it's like Ritalin because I'm already hyper.
Right.
So it would do the opposite and I'd become an introvert and be all like in a corner like, we got to go to Magic Mountain tomorrow.
Now, what year did you... Were you raised? No, you were raised in Texas.
I was raised in the Bay Area.
Oh, Bay Area, okay.
But I was here all the time because I played music. So I hung out in the Comedy Store in the late 80s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, 87, 88, 89, I believe. I don't really remember exactly. Maybe 88. Whenever Dice was really kind of starting,
okay.
He would do the main room. Like, I think they did a potluck in there, and he would kind of go on. You know, like on a Monday, and it was a big deal, man, a line down the corner. People are like, you got to see this guy. He just fucking insults people.
Dice Man just being the epitome of the Dice Man.
Exactly. It was mind-boggling to me because I loved comedy all my life. But comedy was something I went and saw in big theaters. It'd be like Carlin or you know, you go see Kinison or, I mean, but I didn't get to see like, but Cheech and Chong, those guys would do like theaters. And I loved Pryor, but it was the records. But then to see him on stage, you know, and like what he was doing at the time was so radical. Even right now, it's still pretty radical. If you're looking at a couple and you're like, yo, is that your girl? What a whore. You know, you're like, whoa, what the fuck? Like,
this guy is intense.
Yeah, it's radical, right?
Yeah, when I toured with him a couple different times, and it's crowds of people that are there to see him.
Yep.
You know, this was 2005, probably something like that. And so, I mean, it's obviously after his prime, but he's still packing out clubs. And we did a couple theaters in Vegas. There were a couple thousand and stuff, and people just loving it. It's the same thing.
I love that you said that because there's always people, and they're like such fair weather fans in entertainment. Like, you know, like for instance, I love the Black Crowes and I would go see them every year and people would go, yeah, what'd you do? I said, oh, I saw the Black Crowes. Those guys still around? Yeah. Yeah. You know, that just because they didn't have that radio hit that you fucking needed.
They're not,
you know,
on what I mean? Pop radio. So
yeah. And that's what I love about Dice and Pauly and all these guys still working.
Yeah.
And an amazing draw from the days of the grassroots of building what they built.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, who doesn't want that? Like, some people might go like, oh, man, they're out there. That's sad. It's like, what's sad? They wanted to be comedians, and they're doing theaters or small mini theaters and working.
Yeah, I mean, and part of what's cool about comedians is a lot of people, I don't think they are able to differentiate between entertainers in general. So it's like if they're not in a movie or on a TV show, then they're not successful.
Yeah.
But if you have a comedy career and you're out performing several weekends a month, packing out shows, crushing it on the road, you're still very successful
Brian
at your
Regan
main gig.
It's not on TV.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
But
and that guy
just destroys.
Destroys.
A full destroyer.
Massive theaters, cruising around, private jet, whatever.
Making good money, sitting in a cubicle.
That's what I was just going to say. What people don't understand is I'd rather do comedy 25, 30 years later in my career on the backside to 50 people than work at like Chipotle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, what are you fucking talking about?
Even sitting
that's win.
Even sitting in an office where you're making, you know, middle class money sounds like a nightmare to me.
Just selling your fucking hours for, you know, for people that don't give a fuck about you.
At all. They'll fire you in a moment.
They don't give a fuck, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those few businesses, I guess, where you own yourself and you're selling yourself and you don't have to count on other people other than, you know, clubs or whatever it is. But
that's it. That's why I feel like I've already made it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? People are like, you know, man, hopefully you'll get this and that. I go, you don't understand. I'm 49. I've already made it.
Yeah.
I'm doing comedy in Hollywood, California at the number one fucking club.
Regularly.
My name is on the wall.
Yeah.
5 years ago, I wasn't doing comedy.
Right.
I was working at a Harley dealer with dicks around me that were just jaded, bitter, been there too long.
Right.
That the owner's not firing them.
Right.
You know, and I'm just like, this ain't for me. I'd been on stage 25 years. So to get off stage for a couple of years, you go, this is wrong.
Now, you were a musician for a while.
25 years.
25 years of playing music. What was it that finally made you go, you know what? I'm a funny motherfucker. I gotta start doing comedy.
Well,
how do you make that transition?
I wanted to do comedy as a kid, but when I was a kid in the 70s, there wasn't kids doing comedy.
Yeah.
It's not like now where you just go, oh, they got a comedy camp and
everywhere.
And the parents drop you off and you learn comedy. And then there was none of that. It was, the comics that were working when I was young were Bobcat, Bobby Slayton, Kerry Snow, Robin Williams, you know, in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And I loved Saturday Night Live. I'm old enough to know the first couple seasons. I loved John Belushi.
Right.
I fucking loved him. I wanted to be John Belushi.
Yeah.
I would do like stuff in sixth grade at the, like they'd have plays and we'd just do like.
Just reenact skits.
We'd be like, no Pepsi Coke, you know, and that shit. And I really wanted to do it. And at the same time, I fucking worshiped rock and roll.
Yeah.
So the outlaw of comedy and the outlaw of rock appealed to me, same as motorcycles did. Evel Knievel.
Right.
It's just that whole danger element. And
not living life with the same safe path that everyone else is following.
Exactly.
And having no excitement and no stories to tell.
Yeah, my world was already weird. I was born in Yosemite. You know, my mom was a hippie, worked up there. So, you know, I lived in Yosemite and then my parents divorced, but I spent massive amounts of time up there, summer, Christmas and shit. So I was already felt different, you know?
Right.
But I really believe it was early stuff like Belushi and then Caddyshack. I used to love to try to do Carl, you know, silly, really cute, you know, terrible now, but I
could do Bill Murray's.
And I could do my metal shop teacher. He would always be like, put your goggles on. And I would do them exact. And he would get so fucking mad.
That's awesome. Because when I was growing up, I had a gym teacher named Mr. Juracek, who was just a total asshole and a moron.
Yeah.
And I would imitate him all the time. And then when I came to the comedy store, I met random people. I was working here and I kind of started standing out, I guess, a little bit when I was very young doorman by mocking people.
Yeah. That's you could do thing. Guys. Perfect.
So I started,
you could do Argus. Yeah.
And my Argus was literally just my Mr. Juracek impression with a slight more twang and a bunch of Hollywood bullshit stories that I was making up.
Yeah, it's great.
But it was literally just a straight evolution from Mr. Juracek into, hi, bud, into, hi, good to be here, everybody.
I remember first seeing, like, I mean, we're jumping ahead, but I remember would see you, you would do Argus, and I would just be like, oh, fuck, that's exact. And you'd be like, I can't believe how much cocaine I did tonight. You know, it's just hilarious.
Yeah, the Argus, it was interesting because he was untouchable when I showed up. Mitzi was still around a lot, and people were just like, you got to be nice to Argus.
Yeah.
And Argus was always really cool with me, and he, I worked the back door, so it was kind of one of those situations where you're trapped. You can't go anywhere because you have to check IDs. And Argus would come out and start telling me old stories, and he has an amazing way of telling you, like, extended boring parts of Amazing Stories where there's like just these incredible aspects to the story, but he doesn't tell you that part. He tells you like all these details that are not necessary at all. Yeah,
he doesn't self edit.
Yeah,
it's like, funny.
What is he talking about?
Sometimes when I do podcasts, people are like, "Hey, you didn't really get too much into that." It's like, "Hey, man, we're on a podcast. Yeah. It's got to be entertainment."
Yeah,
you know, you got to know how to self edit.
Yeah, I'm not giving you the 3-hour version.
Yeah, right. I do like talking to some of the older guys like Argus and stuff. I like talking to all the levels of comedy.
Yeah.
Because I'm only 5.5 years in, and you could get
it crazy, by the way.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, you were crushing it.
Man, it's
5.5 years is, that's like you're a baby in terms of.
I am, totally.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I'm 5 years old, you know?
I guess maybe. The music gave you stage presence, confidence on stage that it takes other people longer to achieve, I suppose.
I think when you're on stage for 25 years, of course, that's immediately erased.
Right.
But you still have a lot of hurdles, which I wasn't aware of. And recently talked to Burr about it and a few other people. The comics I love are in their 40s.
Okay.
But they've been in the game 20 years and stuff.
Right.
But they're still in their 40s.
Yeah.
The way that business looks at people, it blows my mind. It's like, you know, that Dean guy, he's 49. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, so are the other guys.
Yeah.
Just because I haven't been in that long, I understand what you're saying. But if you're just going on an age thing, all the best guys are in their 40s.
Yeah.
Marin is 52. Yeah. Burr's 45. CK's 46. I'm not comparing myself to them, but what I'm saying is the age.
Yeah, it's irrelevant.
It really is. And everybody always knows the Rodney story. He started, he started when he was young and then he quit and came back in his 40s.
Right.
So I think as long as your material is not in your 40s, as far as like, hey, how about that Pac-Man game?
Right. you stay relevant.
Stay relevant.
Yeah. It's one of those things too, where it's like, you have to have lived life
100
to have
100%
a perspective that is going to be universal or close to it at least.
Yeah.
Like, I've been doing comedy since I was 18 years old, and I thought I was amazing when I was young. Like, it's just one, you're just like, oh, this is great. And looking back, I've watched videos in the last couple of years of me when I was like 20 and doing comedy, and it's such stupid shit.
Yeah.
Because I literally had lived nothing. I'm like 2 years off of just, you know, sucking off my parents' teat still.
Yeah, right.
And it's like the things I'm talking about were so stupid. Yeah. Same like Nick Youssef, when I first showed up here, he wasn't old enough to get in the club yet. And like he'd go on stage and like talk about how stupid shit in high school was.
Right.
And it's like he'd connect with a few of the young people, but everyone else just like,
well, there's adults in
have
the
you,
crowd.
Yeah, it's like, have you not lived at all?
Yeah.
So
I think it's
when you're in your 40s, if you've done it, if you've lived right, you're going to have things to talk about. You're gonna have observed things that are funny.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can tool them up quicker too.
Yeah,
because you're just kind of like, look at that, and you figure out how to try to make that funny without the standard premise of other people. You know, I mean, if everybody's talking about, say, Facebook, I don't even have a Facebook. There's a fan page, but I don't have one. But if everybody's talking about that, and you're in your 40s. That doesn't matter to you much as the time you did too much cocaine at a party in Laurel Canyon. Now people are like, well, let's hear about that.
Yeah, that's something I want to hear about.
That sounds like something fucking funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and also, there's a lot of people who have experienced doing drugs and things like that, and they probably don't have exciting stories for it. It's like, they did some coke with their buddy in Wyoming, and then they sat around and did nothing.
Yeah, right.
So it's like people always think it's going to be crazy, but when you're doing that stuff in a place like the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, things have a tendency to get a little crazier.
Absolutely. And who you're next to doing them.
Right.
You drop down, you do a line.
Jake from the gas station.
Yeah. You look to your right and you go, whoa, that's such and such.
Yeah.
I don't want to blow people's drug use out, but you're like, holy shit, everybody's got this powder in common.
Yeah.
You know, that's really what I love about this place. When I decided to start comedy, I was like, I'm going there because it reminded me of the 80s danger. It's the last dangerous place on Sunset besides the Rainbow.
Right.
You know, because the Rainbow is still exactly the same as it was. So is the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And it feels dangerous. It feels rock and roll, and it really feels legit to me when I got here.
Yeah, there's been, like, I've been here since I was 21, so I've been here for 13 years, coming to the Comedy Store, and there's been multiple waves of extensive drug use.
Yeah.
Where for, you know, a year in some cases, or at least, you know, 5-6 months, where it's just like, there's serious drug usage going on still, where you're just like, what year is it? It's 2007. Why
isn't
is
that
there?
Crazy?
Yeah. You're
like, and I'm walking around going, what is this? 88.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's one of those buildings though, where, like to me, it always seemed when I was here, I used to be here every night.
Yeah.
And, it was like a magnet for crazy people.
Yeah. Last night there was a crazy fucking guy here.
Was that the guy who approached
went on
the stage?
Yeah. And then he was out front. He
took his shirt off.
Yeah. He was like pointing at people but never saying like, you want some of me or any of that. He's like,
right. Full growl.
Just fucking the growler. The growler showed up at the Comedy Store. That'd be great if he was actually, you know, it'd be fucking fantastic is if he was actually working on like a genius next level Kaufman thing.
Yeah. He's
could
like,
you imagine
I'm gonna
that?
Do this.
Like he actually,
I ain't going to say a word the whole time.
I don't say a word. I'm just the angry ex jock.
That'd be so great.
That'd be awesome.
He's a Henry Rollins lookalike, just out there beasting on people.
Cause this guy was pretty fun. I mean, I see some nutty people, but this guy was nuts.
Yeah. Well, I saw him when he took his shirt off.
Yeah.
And I was like, who's that? And someone was like, yeah, he tried to go on stage in the main room. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Why Porter was on. So I was in the green room getting ready to go on, and I hear big laughs. Everything's going on. All of a sudden, I hear silence. I go, oh, fuck. Did he call me up? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, did I miss it? And I run out, and it's some weirdo getting thrown out. You know?
Yeah, that's one of those moments where I'm like, wow, it's nice that the Comedy Store finally has actual security guards. Cause in my day, that would have been my job.
Yeah, right.
It was the funniest to watch the situation where the manager would come out and be like, Ricky, you got to go get him out of here. I'd be like, what?
Yeah.
And back then I weighed like $135.
Yeah.
Hey, just you like, guys, you want me to do what? Yeah. Sorry, you guys got to leave. Who's going to make me? I'd be like, I guess I'll go find someone.
Yeah, right.
It was the main move back then was you'd ask them to leave, and then when they wouldn't, you would just go find Richie Taylor, the manager.
Yeah.
He'd be like, dude, there's some big dude in there, and he won't leave. And just immediately, quarterback Richie's.
I love that guy.
He switched to defense now. He's like, oh, we're going to get him out of here. He'd go in and be so funny. As soon as the guy made one comment about Richie being short or something, it was over.
Oh.
And then it was like, then we had to prevent Richie from instigating this into a full fight.
Yeah, he all of a sudden like, hey, I kind of like this.
Yeah, he's into it. I watched him pick a dude up who was probably 6 or 7 inches taller than him, easily had 40 pounds on him. Rich just picked him up like he was like a midget.
Wow.
Round just underneath the waist, lifted him up, carried him all the way out, and just tossed him in the front patio. And we're like, oh, that's the manager? Perfect.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird dynamic, you know, because you don't know who's in the crowd, you know, and you could touch a guy's button, man. I remember I was doing a gig, and I used to have this bit about Kung Fu schools because they're all over Hollywood. I'm like, who the fuck is taking Kung Fu? No one.
Yeah.
If there was this many schools, you would see a fucking guy once in a while use some Kung Fu at like the Saddle Ranch.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, just one. You'd be like, you know what happened last night? No, what? This guy said, fuck you to a guy. He fucking whipped out nunchucks, a smoke bomb, and just kicked the guy's ass.
He broke out Kung Fu.
Right. He broke out
right there on Sunset.
So I'm doing the bit and I go, you know, there's no fucking Kung Fu, man. It's fake. And some guy from the back of the club goes, I'll show you Kung Fu. And I go, what's that? And I say, look, he's charging towards the stage.
Oh,
like
perfect.
Fucking full speed.
Yeah.
And I'm on the stage. And right when he gets right at the stage, I kick him in his chest.
Nice.
Like fucking, and he goes flying over two rows of fucking tables. And I kicked the wind out of him. So he's like, oh, and they just throw him out. I was like, I don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah.
I'm not even like a fighter or a violent guy. But when your guy's charging you and you're on stage with adrenaline, you're like, this guy's out.
I had a guy charge me once, and luckily the security was in La Jolla.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Oh, yeah. Security down there grabbed him before he got there. But in my mind, I'm already like, what do? Do I spike the microphone off this dude's face?
Something,
I got to do something. Yeah, I mean, I'm defending myself.
Yeah.
But security ran up and grabbed the guy, luckily. But I don't even remember what I said. He was furious. I think I was making fun of Texas.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there you go.
So mad.
It's weird how people forget they're in a comedy club.
Right.
You're up there riffing and having fun, and all of a sudden they go, that guy's talking shit about my state.
Yeah.
And you're going like, yeah, dude, I'm talking about shit about everything.
Yeah.
You know, just your state's one of them. I talked about shit about myself.
We're going to get through all 50 if you give me time, sir.
Yeah, right.
I've had, it took me a while when I started doing a lot of crowd work. I kind of started doing it, learning to do it when I was on the road with Dice. Cause I would do, at the time I just had normal jokes, you know, about being from Kansas and shit. And, Dice crowds were fucking mean.
Yeah.
Like, just brutal. Like, I'd go up there, you know, like, oh, I'm from Kansas. Boom. So that means, get off the stage, pussy. Just like brutal shit. I was 23. I got a lot of, shut up, faggot.
Yeah.
I'd be like, whoa.
Yeah, right.
It was like, there's a couple times where I was just struggling. And then Dice was like, you can't let them see that they're winning. You got to fucking destroy them. Someone yells at you, yell back. I was like, okay. And with the Dice crowd, there's no limits. Like, you can literally just, all you have to say is like, yeah, go suck a dick, faggot.
Yeah.
And the whole crowd will love it.
Yeah.
Like, the more aggressive and mean you are, just straightforward.
Yeah.
The crowd is totally into it. So I was like, oh, okay. So I started doing that. And it was working great for those crowds. But then I'd come back to L.A., perform at the improv.
Go suck a dick.
Yeah, people were just like, geez, this guy's kind of an asshole. I had to fucking learn, like, oh, okay, so in a normal crowd, I got to be more charming about it. You can't just fucking tell someone, I hope your mom dies. And everyone, but here it's like, whoa.
Some girl was talking in the crowd last night. She just kept talking and talking and talking. Main room, you're in there.
Yeah.
I finally look over, I go, what the fuck are you doing? She goes, my friend got in a car crash. I'm like, good. Now you know how I feel.
Yeah.
I'm up here. I'm in a car crash.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
With you talking.
Yeah.
I didn't mean good that her friend was in a car crash, but it was like, all right, you've got a little pain. I'm going through this pain of you talking through my set right now.
You know where a great place to discuss your friend's car crash is? Outside of the showroom.
Yeah. Go to her fucking rescue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Don't stay in the showroom.
Go in the fucking hallway.
Carol got in a car crash.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
That's ridiculous.
I love watching you. It's funny because the way I approached comedy was the first year, of course, I was just trying to get on. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, like 3-5 minutes or whatever working stuff. The second year, I approached it like, I'll go on first in any show. I wanted to see what it was like. No one wants to go first.
Yeah.
And if I could get more spots, I'd say, hey, if I can get on the show, I'll go first. I don't care. When you say I'll go first, you'll get a lot of spots.
Yeah, a lot of people are into that.
Yep.
They're and like, you're volunteering? Okay.
Yeah, and you learn how to cold open. And then the third year, I said, I'll go last any show you got. Not headline, last. Yeah. Talking about after the...
They put up everyone on the lineup.
15 dudes, and, yeah. Got a lot of spots that way. The fifth year, which is like I'm on the... Which is all of last year.
Okay.
I did completely, mostly a lot of crowd work to work that muscle.
Yeah.
And I watched you and I watched a lot of guys. Godfrey did a lot of fun crowd work, but a lot of guys, but you a lot. And then you start to see the art of that. You know, you don't want to be mean.
Right.
Sometimes you are mean. I've gone on and went, fuck, I was too mean tonight.
Yeah.
It's just how I am. I can't just, sometimes I go on, I'm mad. I'm, I'm not mad. I'm just overworked or whatever. And I get on and I shower and I'm ready to go on. And I come down and someone's like, yeah, this guy's not a star. Now I'm angry.
Yeah.
You know, cause it's like,
you deserve as much respect as anyone else.
I'm in the middle of this lineup for some reason. You know what I mean? I'm working
it's
hard.
It's not an accident.
Just give me a couple minutes.
Yeah.
You know? So I learned a lot from doing the crowd work. And I also loved when I watched the Louis C.K. episode, there was one where Godfrey was on and the way he tipped his hat to crowd work was amazing. What he said was he had his niece at the cellar. He had to babysit his niece and Godfrey was on and his niece goes, oh, God, this guy's so funny. And Louis goes, yeah, man. He's just doing crowd work, you know? And she goes, I don't know what it is, but it's great. It's funny.
Yeah.
So in the next scene, you see Louis, he's up there and he's like, hey, nice shirt. The guy goes, just do jokes, asshole. You know, that was his way of showing that's a fucking art.
Yeah.
It's an art form.
And it's a skill that not everyone has. So.
It really is because I remember one time Cap watched me and he goes, man, that's a danger. You know, because your crowd work could be bigger than your bits.
Right.
And so I was like, I enjoy that challenge.
Yeah.
Let's see if I can make them both.
Yeah.
Great.
I mean, I'm at the point now where I'm trying to do more bits.
I see you. Yeah.
And do less crowd work because it got to the point where I
can't get on TV.
I was doing all crowd work and I did that for years. And it's like, but this is great for me and the comedians that are here every night and don't want to see the same set. But no one in the industry is interested in seeing it.
Yeah.
And it's like one of those things where like if you get successful, then they'll be happy to watch it. And then at that point, you'll be brilliant. But until then, it's like he's just up there making fun of people. So
I think
I'm trying to get it to where my bits are as...
It's great. That's a great formula, though, because if you're crushing with crowd work and your bits are crushing, you're undeniable.
Yeah.
Because you can weave in and out, I've learned.
You're prepared for every situation.
Yeah.
Like, there's a couple comics, and I won't say names because I don't want to sell anyone out, but they're great, great comics.
Yeah.
And I just watch them crush so many times here, main room, OR, and been a couple times where... You know, someone was doing something stupid in the crowd or being loud or whatever, and it just completely threw them off.
Yeah.
And then it was just a disaster for the last 8 minutes because they were so flustered that they couldn't go straight through their bits where it's like every single breath is prepared. I just remember being like, man, that to me, that looks horrifying.
I don't want to be helpless at any point.
Yeah.
So I wanted to learn the bit. When I grew up, you know, I grew up, it was called capping, you know, some people, now it's like big thing is roasting, but you know, the locker in between periods, like, yo man, what's with those shoes for, you know, your mama shops at Kmart, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I can see when you're pushing a guy's button to a limit to where they want to fight.
They're about to snap. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a fine line, but I was really good at it. And I pushed it down because it was almost too evil all the time.
Right.
But now I've figured out how to tap into it a little bit. If they're shitty, I'll fucking be shitty to them. But if they're good, I'll riff and have fun, you know?
Yeah. And another thing that it took me a while to learn, but was, one, if someone's acting like an asshole, you can shred them to pieces and
totally.
People will be on your side. It's tough to do crowd work with females because, in general, people see them as being victimized when you do that.
Right.
But if they're drunk and being loud, then it's a fucking witch hunt and they're happy to watch you destroy her.
Absolutely.
But one of the things that it took me a while to learn was a kind of army mentality of sometimes you sacrifice one for the greater good of everyone.
Right. All the time.
And
all the time. Let's fix this.
Yeah. And as long as you don't focus for forever on that one person,
yep.
You move from person to person, everyone gets a little piece. People are generally cool with it.
Yep.
Even if it's like you make fun of them, they look uncomfortable, but they know, you know, in a minute you're going to be making fun of someone else. So
yeah. Yeah.
But
I use it as a callback.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times.
It's an inside joke at that point.
Exactly.
So everyone in the crowd is going to relate.
Exactly.
There's an issue that I always saw with comedy of comics, you know, they go up their set and you know, sometimes they're doing a bit that means something to them and 30% of the crowd totally gets it. But then 70% of the crowd just like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. It happens a lot with when you see comics doing bits about their kids.
Yep.
And there's a lot of young kids in their 20s in the audience. And they're just sitting there like,
check it out.
I don't have any responsibility at all. I don't know. This doesn't make any sense to me. It's not really that funny. But if you're interacting with people, then everyone's in on that.
Yeah. So, I recently have been trying to get this bit to work for a year. It fucking works, but only with about 30% of the people, like you're saying. And it's such a big part of me, but it's a bit about people say rock is dead.
Right.
And I say, I don't believe that, you know, it's just, you don't care anymore or you don't know how to steal it on the internet. But when, you know what I'm saying? That's just the bottom line.
Yeah.
It's not dead. There's
tons of music.
50 bands right now that are incredible right now. And I'm 49 and they're new bands. Like, wow, there's some great music. So I have this big bit about it's not dead. It's just not dangerous anymore.
Right.
And then I go through the bit.
I've heard it. It's very funny.
Sometimes it crushes, like it crushes over at Meltdown, where it's a comic book, where they're into art and music and movies and everything. But if it's a crowd that's just not passionate about music like me, they're just out completely. Yeah. And it's crazy because I'm like, most of my bits, even if you don't know, if you're not down with what I'm talking about, you're on board because it's, you know.
You're presenting it professionally, right.
But this one is just always 30-80, you know, maybe 50-50. And once in a while, when it's 100%, I go, oh, I finally got that thing working again.
Right.
You know, and it's just.
Like, I figured it out.
It's not, and then the next day, it's not. And like, I really want it because I'm fucking a rock.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like weird. So, yeah.
Who got you in at the store? Did you just show up and start doing open mics?
Yeah.
You did the open mic here?
Yeah, I did. I started, December 6th, 2010, I believe it is.
Okay. And had you been doing comedy elsewhere or did you start here?
Here's what happened. I played music 25 years. And then it was just kind of over because I was never a star, but I made records and it was during the era where you could just kind of play forever and make a living, you know, jam bands were big, alt country was big. And it was kind of like a Ryan Adams Springsteen kind of Black Crowes thing. So you could just tour all over. And I toured with the Wallflowers for 10 months, you know, stuff like that, out opening for them.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Open for some big bands, open for Petty, Lucinda Williams, Lenny Kravitz, Black Crowes, stuff like that, you know,
cool. All
but never really made it to the next level. But I was, a working musician. It's what I did.
Right.
And then as the downloading went away, and I always tell this story, this is really what would happen after the shows. I'd be like, hey, you guys want to buy a CD? And they'd be like, no, my friend burned it for me. We love it. Thank you, though. And they don't understand. They're going, we stole it, you know.
You're not getting any money, we're into it.
Yeah. So I'd come home. To me, I could play all my life like that until it burned to the ground. But when you have band members and they're going, hey, my wife, we're gone a whole summer and I came home with $400.
Right.
Now it's over with.
Yeah.
So I was kind of, I remember my last gig, really. I had toured with the Wallflowers and it was incredible. And I came home and I was playing Genghis Khan. They had that Chinese restaurant place.
Yeah. A buddy of mine actually just moved out to LA. He was performing there two Fridays ago.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm in that box and I remember I'm playing it solo acoustic and there's just people texting and not, and I just got off this big massive tour, you know, like fucking badass
jamming,
feeling great. And I was like, you know what, man? And this is really like 06, 05. Like MySpace had burned to the ground, kind of.
Yeah.
And Facebook was
a quick rise.
Out.
And yeah.
But it was fun. It's funny. It's just like comedy. You could have 2 million followers on something and go on the road and no one will come out.
Yeah.
So and this is, I'm sidetracking for 1 minute because I have this thing, the story I read about 1,000 fans. A guy wrote recently, you can Google it, Google 1,000 fans. He said, if you have 1,000 true fans, you could survive as an artist the rest of your life. Because true fan means when you put a ticket on sale, boom, they buy one or a shirt or a CD or a DVD. Each fan spend about $100 on you a year. That'd be about $100,000. Maybe you take home maybe 40 or
right.
50, let's just say. You could survive forever. And that sounds easy. 1,000 fans, and it's fucking hard.
Yeah.
My point is
true fans.
My point is I toured with the Wallflowers for 10 months and I came home. You think, oh, your life's gonna change. I'm back at Genghis Khan, you know.
Right.
And there's four people texting in my face. They're waiting for their friend to go on.
Yeah, you know, they don't give a shit about anyone other than the person they came to see.
Yeah, and I remember I walked out of there, I put my guitar in my car. I had a 4Runner at the time and I drove up to the house, and in my mind, I was like, that was it. That was the last gig. I knew it in my mind, you know?
Just like, I can't
do this. Yeah, because I had run its course,
yeah.
You know? And so I got this job. I go, well, what do I love? I love Harleys.
Right.
So I got a job over in Van Nuys doing selling motorcycles. And I was really into it for a while. I was like, God, yeah, I love it. I was making
money.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There was 1 month where I made $12,000.
Jesus.
You understand when you make no fucking money your whole life as an
yeah.
artist? $12,000 selling
yeah.
bikes. And I was like, you know, because I had people skills.
Right.
And I had passion.
And you had knowledge on
yeah,
the subject.
Yeah, and I loved motorcycles.
Right.
Just like I love stand-up and music. So that was great for a while. And then 06 kind of happened, 07, which is Fannie Mae and all that shit crashed.
Right.
No one was buying bikes and the banks weren't giving loans. So you'd get a guy to buy one and he wouldn't qualify.
Right.
So all of a sudden I was making, like, I'm not kidding you, 900 1 month for 30 days of work, 6 days a week, $940.
Ouch.
I remember I was like, this is over. And a guy walked on the lot, and I've never told this story really extensively, but this is what happened. A guy walked on the lot. He said, we need some motorcycles for a movie. And I said, yeah, what movie? And they said, it's a Quentin Tarantino film called Hell Ride. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll help you guys. I love fucking Tarantino. That's
yeah.
great. So I help them, and then they hire me as a consultant to consult, like, what the guys wear and stuff. It's a biker.
Make it legit. And,
yeah. So it's Dennis Hopper, Michael Madsen, and it's supposed to be Quentin at the time playing this role. And then that guy, Vinnie Jones.
Okay.
So one day the guy comes down and goes, hey, man, we got a small role for you. Can you come in and audition? I go, sure, fuck yeah. I come in and audition. I get the role as this ape shit. And so that was the name of the character. And this is how fucking delusional I am. I'm like, man, it's going to suck when I go to the store and stuff. People are like, ape shit. You know, like Turtle from Entourage,
yeah.
you know, Jerry's a friend of mine. Hey,
yeah.
you're a turtle.
Yeah.
That's all I kept thinking, like, oh, they're going to be
I'm
calling
not gonna
me.
Live this down.
Yeah. yeah. I'm just thinking that I'm already fucking buying houses and shit
yeah.
in my mind, you know, Tarantino.
Yeah.
Then we start up. I realize Tarantino goes, I don't want to act anymore. He drops out. They get Eric Belford to play his role. And it's a Tarantino Presents.
Right.
You know, it's part of that grindhouse thing.
Sure.
So I do the movie. And it was fucking amazing because there's no man I love more than Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
Because he's
legend.
He's
ultimate artist, actor. And
ultimate.
Yeah.
If I look at any high watermark, it's that man, because
yeah.
what people don't understand is he was a photographer.
Yeah.
He was a filmmaker and he was an actor. And not only was he an
iconic
actor, he was the only guy that worked with John Wayne, James Dean, Marlon Brando.
Wow.
Okay. He did two James Dean films. He worked with Brando in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And he did a John Wayne film.
Wow.
No one's done that. Then he directs the iconic fucking a biker film, Easy Rider.
Easy Rider, yeah.
He's in the best David Lynch film ever, Blue Velvet.
Right.
He directs Colors, the first kind of gang film.
Sean Penn's
finest
role.
Right.
Pac-Man.
Yep. So I'm like blown away. And now I'm like, oh my God, this is fucking amazing, man. And I come back to work and I go, I'm out of here.
Yeah,
man.
What am I doing?
Yeah, I'm out of here. You know, there's no money.
I'm ape
stuff.
Shit. I don't need this.
Yeah, I'm ape shit. And I get an audition for an Ice Cube movie called The Long Shots.
Okay.
Football movie.
Right.
And shot out in Shreveport. And I don't get the role. And the first day of shooting, they fire the guy that I auditioned for and they fly me out and all of a sudden I'm on the film. And it's a $35 million film, like a big one from the $2 million Hell Ride.
Right.
And now it's all of a sudden like, wow, I'm working with Ice Cube, who I worshipped as a kid, NWA.
Right.
Like there was, to me, that was the new rock.
Yeah, that's as dangerous as music got for a
decade. Fuck yeah, it was Guns N' Roses and then it went NWA. And so I'm on the film. And the guy, and it's basically five guys in the bleachers that are doing crowd work, like, oh, he got it in the nuts, that kind of stuff. Sure. You know? And the guy next to me was a guy named Earthquake.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know who he was. And at the time, I had always go see comedy. Jay Davis had that show, Life of the Party. And I'd go down and see comedy, but I'd never heard of him. And he's like, yeah, man. I go, and then Garrett Morris is on the film, who I worshipped from SNL. Season one and two, yeah. You know, SNL. So now I'm like, holy shit, man, this is cool. So I start talking to him about comedy and what do I do? And they're like, yeah, get out of here, man. You're 44. You know? You're like, I'm like, no, really? I want to try this. Like, yeah, sure.
Little eight kid.
Yeah, right. They're just like, dude, you're fucking, you're old, you know?
Right.
We're on this dumb film out in Shreveport. You're not doing comedy.
Right.
After a while, though, Earthquake would drop a couple nuggets on me. And at the end of the shoot, he goes, if you try it, I run a show at the Comedy Union. Come out anytime on Wednesdays, I'll put you on. So I get home. And I immediately start doing open mics.
Nice.
And I come here. I remember. Yeah. I was like, all right, I'm going to the store, man. That's me.
That's how I was, too. It's the first place.
Signed up on the potluck. Everybody's like, yeah, you never get on, you know. And I was on.
Nice.
First. You know, I remember the sun was still out.
Yep.
Because right now in the summer is the worst for potluck. Because
it starts at 7.
Yeah, the sun's
out. 2 hours of sunlight in a giant window right next to the stage.
Yeah. And Tony Hinchcliffe was hosting. And I remember I went on and I was like, why are all the people sitting in the back? You know?
Right.
And I was shaking because I hadn't, you know, it's like I'm doing comedy. Like, whoa. Right. And it was really, I've skydived twice. And it was really like skydiving. It's just kind of like,
yeah.
When you skydive, there's so much adrenaline, more than any adrenaline you've ever got. You kind of phase out for a second. It's like,
yeah.
And that's what it was like.
An unreal moment.
Totally. There's no one in the crowd. You remember, like, when I started, even when you were around, no one was coming to the store.
Yeah. No one was coming here. And they definitely weren't coming to the open mic.
No.
Like, when I was doing open mics, it was, like 2002 to 2004 or five, essentially. And I guess I continued to do it on those nights anyway, but there was no one here with reason. Like half the lineup on the open mic were like crazy fucking lunatics who like never had a chance at progressing as a comedian stuff. And then there was a handful of guys who had a reasonable shot, but they didn't get up that often because they were losing spots to Boonshocks and Nikki and Gaylord Dinglers.
That was the shit that was blowing me away.
Yeah.
You know, because you're like, oh, wait, there's homeless people. Yeah, and I can't get on.
Is that the level I'm at?
Yeah, right.
I remember doing an open mic here where there was this old lady named Ziggy who was like just barely not crazy enough to be locked up somewhere.
Yeah.
And then Gaylord and Mickey and Boonshock. And there was times where it was like, they would do 40 people signed up, 20 comics would go up, 3 minutes. That was the deal back then. And you had to sign up a week ahead of time. And then if you picked a number, you got to go up the following week. And be like, I'd come up here, sign up, and then would hear the names they picked off and just be like, that fucking asshole?
Yeah.
Like, why are they giving these guys fucking even an opportunity?
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're not a fucking lunatic, it's pretty easy to separate yourself.
Absolutely.
It's just a matter of getting that opportunity.
Right. You know,
who are you open micing with? Do you remember any of the,
I'll tell you one great story. Before I came to the Comedy Store, there was kind of this thing where you could, do you want to do comedy? Like, try it out. Like, people like a doctor or whatever. And you could do, like a show at the Improv. This guy put on like once a month. It was like a bringer show. But it was for people that always wanted to try comedy, you know? Okay. So my first spot was at the Improv on a Sunday, and it was sold out. All my friends were there, and I killed, you know? Yeah. Like, but your friends are there,
right?
You know? I remember I was doing some joke about BO. Like my buddy said, don't use deodorant because it causes cancer. And I'm like, dude, your BO is killing me. I'd rather die from, you know, from deodorant than your fucking BO. And it was killed. And then my second show, some guy saw me there and they put me in the belly room. It was Jerome and that, Cleary.
Jerome Cleary
and another guy. And they put me on, and I didn't know it was a gay show.
Awesome.
Yeah. So this is like 4 days later, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a natural.
Yeah.
And I went on, and I had this bit where I said, man, I had a dream. I was sucking my friend's dick. Well, that's gross. And no laughs.
Yeah.
And this is exactly how I opened the other show. I studied it. You know what I mean? I studied the 5-minute tape. Yep. Oh, man, I'm going to do it exact.
Inflections, make sure I get everything. The cadence down.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I breathe there. I'm studying all the moves. And I said, gross. And I remember all of a sudden it was silent. And I heard this guy go, what's so gross about that? Yikes. Another guy goes, yeah. And I look and I go, oh, shit. There's all men in here.
These guys are dick suckers.
And I was like, oh, fuck. Now I would just handle like, no, it was just gross because the guy was like, you know, he had a small dick. Yeah, like, whatever, you could just riff on something.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I was like, oh. And then I just
froze. I didn't prepare for this.
Yeah. And I just fucking ate it so bad. So bad. So then I went home and that was a Friday. And then I came to the potluck. I remember I got on Sunday. And then I went on. I didn't get any laughs because there's no one in there.
Yeah.
And you don't realize, like, there's no one in there. You can do bad. But in your mind, I'm like, I'm eating it again.
Yeah.
And I got off, and then Tony roasted me on something. He's like, there's a midlife crisis, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then I burned rubber out of there, and I disappeared for a year and never came back to the clubs and just did open mics 7 days a week. I never missed a day.
Nice.
7 days a week for a full year, and I came back. I remember I signed up and I got on, and I did good,
like
really good. And then Alex Moore came up and went, that was some funny shit, man. Keep coming around.
He was 7-footer.
Yeah, he was running it. And he's like, I like you, man. He had tattoos and he was like a biker.
Big dude, yeah.
And Alex Moore was really the only guy that talked to me ever at the store for the first year or so. Like, I just didn't know anyone. And then I just stayed. I came to the store every fucking day. I would stay till 3-4 a.m. Remember, the doors would be open.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't leave. I was just studied each guy, and I'd find new guys like, oh my God, this guy's great.
Yeah.
And then, you know, oh, I love Eric Griffin. And then I remember that what really changed it for me was I saw Ian Edwards. And that's when
guy's incredible.
That's when it changed for me completely. My whole life was, I looked and I was like, whoa, this guy's doing crazy, edgy shit. And they're laughing. I love this stuff. And that's when my eyes opened up.
Right.
Completely to another thing.
Two great points he just made that I think a lot of people don't understand when it comes to comedy. One, it makes more sense now how quickly you've progressed from the simple fact that you were doing shows every night.
Yeah.
A lot of people, when they get started into comedy, make the mistake of thinking like, oh, I go up once a week. That's pretty good. And you will literally, it'll take you 30 years
absolutely
to grow if that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like when I started in Kansas City when I was in college, and I could literally get up, if I was lucky, twice a week. And that was part of the reason why I wanted to move to LA when I was 21. Once I could get into clubs, I'm like, I got to go because it's going to take me a lifetime to get the stage time I need here. And
I compare that to motorcycle riding.
Yeah.
A guy that only rides on Sunday is never going to be a good rider, and he's going to end up crashing or getting hurt or whatever.
Right.
Because every time you get on that bike, you're like, whoa, cars. Whoa.
Right.
Whoa, people. Well, I'm on the freeway.
It needs to become like breathing to
it
you.
It needs to become your fucking, your the
part
stage
of who you are.
And everything is you.
Right.
When you step on there. So go ahead.
Yeah. And the second thing is you have to watch comedy.
You have to watch it.
You're never like, I'm at a point now where sometimes it's tough for me to watch it just because I've been watching for so long, but I watched every night for hours when I first moved out here and started. And it's not the only way, but it's the quickest way that you're going to learn just little things. You're going to learn ways, tricks people have.
Yep.
And, ways of telling jokes and things of that nature. Like if you don't watch comedy, stuff not to do, especially you can learn a lot about what not to do.
I always tell people this: when I was playing music, if somebody came up to me and said, dude, down the street, AC/DC rehearses every day and you can watch them for free as long as you want, I would have fucking been there every day how to become a powerhouse rock band.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I say AC/DC or Zeppelin or whatever, because they're such a high caliber to me, that's the caliber of comedy that was going on in there.
Yeah.
And so I said, you mean I could sit back here and watch them all night long free? I can watch Chris Rock rolling.
Yeah, that's exactly
I can
what
watch
I was
Sebastian.
Thinking. Yeah.
I can watch Louis C.K.
Bill Burr.
I can watch Bill
crushing.
Burr.
Yeah.
I mean, and the way everything you learn how they bring the guy up. You learn the other people's credits. So if you ever get past, you know their credits because you've been in the room.
Yeah.
You know how to fucking be mean, when to be mean, not to be mean, when the blue star comes on.
How far is too far?
Everything, man. Yeah. And I would come in. I wouldn't come to the store. This is a mistake I tell people don't do. They come home here and they just sit, but they haven't gone on in the night. I do all the open mics I can, and then I end my night here.
Right.
So sometimes I would get here, and Ian would be on, and it would be a different level of guy, different guys. The next time I get here, it'd be Eric Griffin. Like, you know, different hours I would be here.
Right.
So.
And again, you're doing the two things that are going to speed you along.
Exactly.
I mean, it literally seems like you've been doing comedy for a decade and a half.
Also, I've done over 2,600 spots now.
Okay, so
and
you're jumping right in, and you're saying, you know what? I think I am going to swim, but not in a pool. I'm going to go ahead and try and swim from Alcatraz.
And then I put them all down, you know.
Oh wow!
I put them in my phone, and then I log them just to know when I started a new joke.
Wow.
When the joke started working, where I went on, you know what I mean?
Man, that's incredible.
And I have them all, you know, in my mind. And these are just regiments of things, of discipline I needed, because when you're 49, you easily want to stay on the couch and just fucking sleep. You know what I mean? So I created a thing of like, okay, I got to get the fuck out of the house by 7 or I'm not going to leave the house.
Right.
Now I'm out of the house. I'm here. I go to a coffee shop or whatever, and I plot what I'm going to work on. And then I get to the open mic and I only work on that stuff that I plotted on working on. I don't go and just go, hey, what are you guys talking about? It's like, I'm at work. Let's do these. And then I go to the next open mic and go, this didn't work that good. I listen to it.
Tweak it.
Yeah. And keep doing it. So it was really a work ethic. And also the Comedy Store really saved my life because I was 44. All my friends were married. I had been an artist all my life. And all of a sudden, I got no friends in Hollywood. Are you going to hang out with 20-year-olds?
Yeah.
So this place saved me because all of a sudden there's guys my age, like Bill Burr, who's into rock music, or you and I fucking talk, you know what I mean? Or Eric Griffin.
There's enough characters and oddballs that this is one of those few places in the world where if you're weird, you fit in.
Exactly.
If you're a normal person, you won't fly here.
And you know
but
what?
If
we're
got,
weird as fuck. We're, like, I can't go to hang with friends and have kids and shit because I've never had kids and I've been in the entertainment business all my life. So when you're at a house and they're like, it's Jimmy's 4th birthday, I'm like, man, I saw AC/DC on Back in Black tour. You know what I mean?
I remember Jason Glurn inviting me. Yeah, it comes. My kid's birthday, man. He's going to be 3. I'm like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I can't go to your kid's birthday party. It's going to be weird.
It's so true, right? And then people are just like, so what do you do? And they try to make you feel shitty.
Yeah.
Like, so you're pretty much just a loser, huh? You're not a homeowner and married and with a seven-figure job. It's like, nah. Yeah, no, I don't want to be that.
Not
either.
Gonna be either. Yeah,
I'm not gonna be. You know, so it really saved my life. And last night, people always say, oh, "I hear that place is haunted." The Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And this really happened to me last night. And this is why I was glad that we're doing the podcast today. It was the first time I got off in the main room, and I had a great set. I felt good, and I was walking, and then it felt like something went in me. I was like, whoa, man. And I realized, and I always say this, but I walked down the hall, I went, man, this fucking place is great, man. That just came out of me without anything. It was almost like Tourette's. I was like, fuck, this place is great.
Yeah.
It was weird. It felt like a ghost went in me.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's so many times where I'm just like, this place is fucking, the energy in this place is just addicting.
It is.
And it's like 2 weeks ago, I think it was two weekends ago, I did main room show here on a Saturday night, and it was like sold out, like 350 people or whatever it was, just packed. And followed D'Elia, he just crushed. And the crowd just kept the energy going. So it's like everything I was saying, like, he had done so well, they were just ready to keep laughing. So then I did great and had so much fun. And then I had a spot at the Improv. So I was just like, keep this shit going. Went over to the Improv and there was nine people there. And
stole your soul.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this isn't the same vibe at all. And the show was okay. It was, I can't think of his name right now, was hosting it. So he was doing like 15 minutes in between each act.
Oh.
It was just like, there's nine people here.
Yeah.
Just fucking get through this.
Yeah. Let's just burn through them.
So then my 12:15 spot, it was like 1:40 by the time I got up.
Oh.
It was just like, oh man,
I can't stand when people are rude like that when there's no one in the room.
Yeah.
Or just when they're rude in general, you know, it's just like, there's no one here. Let's just eat, do it and go eat.
I have a mentality with hosting that to me, it seems like this should just be the mentality. Like, everyone should follow this rule. And it's obviously not the case, and everyone does their own thing. But the way I look at it, when you're hosting a show, it's not your show. You're working for the show.
Yep.
You're there to keep that thing going. You're not supposed to act like you need to do a full headliner.
Yeah, they're doing 4 15-minute spots.
Yeah.
I got my headliner set in each.
Split up.
Split up like a pizza.
Terrible. It was so frustrating. I'm just like, man.
I tell you, you learn a lot when you're coming up. You learn who's mean to you, and you learn who's good to you. And I just brush it off because it used to bother me. And then I realized, you know what? I worked a job where all the people sucked. 8 hours a day with them.
Yeah.
This is just 2-3 minutes in a hallway.
Right.
And we're all in this fucking hard ass shit. As corny as it sounds, man, pick your guy up and try to fucking, you know, it's like war out there, man.
Yeah.
And sure, there's going to be comedy that you don't like or styles or whatever. But you know what? If everybody was Bill Hicks, it wouldn't work. I love Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
But if everyone was Bill Hicks, it just doesn't work. You know what I mean? If everybody is Jim Carrey, it doesn't work. You know, you need all flavors. And once I started realizing that, I'm like, all right, I'm good with myself, you know? And I learned a lot from Bill Burr on that. Cause you're easy to go like, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I don't even know the guy.
Yeah. I don't care. I used to be really bad. I talk a lot of shit, but I used to be horrible. Like, for it's just like, so I would just despise somebody because I didn't like their style of comedy.
Right.
And I eventually matured to where I'm just like, let him do his shit. What do I care? If crowds like it, crowds like it.
I remember Robert Kelly told me something he said on my podcast. You know, it's a lot like I used to judge people by the music they listen to. And it's like, well, are we in sixth grade? You can't be friends with that guy because he doesn't like, you know, Mars Volta.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just like, they probably didn't grow up as an only child and needed something to escape. They right. probably had some family love.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they love the NFL. Right. I don't love the NFL. You yeah. know what I mean? It's like, sure, I yeah. love the 49ers. I saw some of the best shit, but it's not my life, you know? So right. I try to figure it out. It's tough though, because it's so fucking hard what we do. And you've got all these dynamics around it, you know, and you're just going, fuck, man, let's just try to work together. But,
yeah,
you know, it is what it is. You need a little bit of evil, though.
For sure.
To get that good comedy.
Yeah. No one's going up and crushing with just my life has always been
fuck
great.
No. Fuck no, man. And, you know, it's only probably going to get darker for me, you know.
Yeah.
The more you figure out your voice, the more you're like, I'll just let it all out there.
Right.
You know,
now you've opened for a lot of great comics. I'll see you posting,
yeah.
going for a lot of great guys. Who's been, has the most fun crowds for you? Who do you love touring with?
They're all different. So I opened for Marin, opened for Russell Peters, opened for D'Elia, opened for Bill Burr, opened for Eric Griffin, those are all different. Eric Griffin, great crowd because it's Workaholics fans.
Right.
They're young. They love music. They party.
Right.
They're still living like it's fucking,
like they're in their 20s.
Exactly. which they are.
Yeah. You know?
So that's a great dynamic for me. I love to open for Burr or Marin because it's a serious fucking comedy crowd. And then you go, all right, I want to be a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be a character, you know, like people, right. you know, sometimes they're like, this guy's a character, but it's like, I'm a comedian, man.
Right.
And in those crowds, you want to be a comedian. So those are fun because they're really stressful because those are the comedy nerds out there.
Right.
The Marin crowd is probably the most, the best loyal comedy crowd.
It's a smart, cynical crowd too.
Right.
So like they're ready to hate.
They are.
They came to see Mark Maron and they're going to love him,
yeah.
but you got to bring a game.
And Maron really changed my life. So, when I was on his podcast, it changed my life the next day. So I love doing that. And then the D'Elia crowd is fun because it's a lot of dates. So the women love Chris and then the dudes love me. They're like, all right, this guy's crazy.
Nice.
You know what I mean? I love that part of it, you know? So that's fun. I'm picking up dudes. They're like, yeah, I brought the lady, you know, she loves Chris. I like that shit.
That's funny.
And they're all great guys, man. I've been fucking so lucky to work with these people because I've learned so much from them and they're all great people in their own way. And the help they've given me is beyond. Without them, I'm still in the belly room for real without them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my comedy progressed a lot quicker once I was able to go on the road with Paulie and Dice and like just do real comedy in a place where there's real Americans there.
Yeah.
It's not Southern California
showbiz
industry
bastards.
You might even call them.
Really different, right?
It is. It's very weird. And the Dice thing for me is kind of the opposite of what you're saying with D'Elia.
Yeah.
Like I'd go to a Dice show. And once I got control of my comedy and it was like, I was doing well at these shows, dudes would go. And a lot of times, I don't know why they'd bring a girl with them.
Yeah.
And the dudes obviously love Dice, so they love everything he does and says. And afterwards, every chick that was at the show would come up and be like, oh my God, I loved you. You know, you were so
great.
And I wasn't really so into him. I'm like, yeah, you think?
Yeah.
Is it because he called you whores?
Yeah, you whores!
For an hour and 10 minutes? But yeah, it was great. It was always like dudes waiting around to talk to Dice and then just tons of girls just, oh my God, you were so great. And I loved everything you said. And I got to have cool experiences. I always say like when I went with Paulie, you go to places where, people love son-in-law. That's essentially, that's like the demographic that he's pulling. That was the one movie wherever we went, people would always be, hey, Paulie, if you want to come over and stay with us this week and we can make another son-in-law. It'd be like we'd be in Shreveport or Brownsville, Texas.
Yeah.
And so it was like I'm seeing all these random middle America, Bible Belt places, Dayton, Ohio, Wichita.
Yeah, he does them all. Yeah. Saw the documentary.
Yeah. So it's like, I was seeing places I guarantee I will never see outside doing comedy. And, you know, someday I'll probably do comedy there again, but
it's incredible. Though,
you're not
right?
going to go to that place otherwise.
Yeah.
And then with Dice, he's very specific. Like with his crowd is very specific. And I know he does random shows every once in a while. Like he'll do a casino in Oklahoma or something. Yeah. But for the most part, it's like he does Miami, New Jersey, New York, Vegas.
Wow.
And so it's like, you're just doing these cool places. Yeah. Where it's like, I'm going 2 weeks with Paulie to Nowheresville.
Yeah.
And then it's like, then I'm spending a week in Coconut Grove in Miami with Dice, just fucking feeling like I'm on top of the world.
Yeah.
Got to meet OJ Simpson, came to one of our shows.
Yeah, you also met fucking Mitch Hedberg.
Mitch Hedberg,
fuck,
yeah.
Fuck, man.
Hedberg and OJ together.
Come on.
And then I mistakenly gave Hedberg his bag of vitamins back.
I love that
and,
story.
Yeah, and then he was dead like 3 months later. I'm like, God, I sure hope that that had nothing to do with that bag of pills I saved for him. But it's like those experiences are stuff that, in my mind, like, I'm so proud of having that, and I'm so excited about, like, just the thought of being like, man, I was 23 years old, and I was hanging out, getting drunk with O.J. Simpson and Mitch Hedberg.
When I was a kid, Dice was the biggest.
Yeah.
And then I brought him on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I listen to this story, man. I was fucking... Chris Rock was a god to me when I was growing up.
He's the one who made me want to be a comedian.
I saw
Bring the Pain and Bigger and Blacker made me want to be
him
comedy.
Him and Seinfeld... were the dudes to me. Like, I would see him every time they were, like, I went and saw Seinfeld all over Vegas, Tahoe, Circle Star Theater in San Jose.
Nice.
You know, I'd go see these guys, and Chris Rock, man. I saw Chris Rock at the Paramount Theater two different times, and Mario Joyner opened both times, and it was some of the funniest laughing I've ever had, just killing. I was in the store a year ago, and I just finished my set. And then Jeff Scott said, oh, we got a special guest. And I go, oh, cool. Who is it? And he came up and he whispered in my ear. And I thought he said Chris Farley as a joke. You know what I mean? I just thought, like, Chris, what? And he goes, yeah, Chris Rock. And I was like, wow. Yeah. I'm fucking bringing up Chris Rock right now. Like, one of the reasons I do comedy.
Yeah.
And I brought him up and it was just unbelievable, you know, that kind of shit you just never forget, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I brought up Chris Rock twice, and the first time I did it, I was like, oh man, this guy, he was the first comic that whose special I watched where I was like, that's what I want to do with my life.
Yeah.
And I was a huge fan of him on SNL. Like, that's the era of SNL.
Right.
I grew up watching. I was born in 81, so like late 80s, early 90s when it was like Phil Hartman.
I was a sophomore in high school.
So, but yeah, those are the guys that like I wanted to be. And so I brought him up, you know, just gave some of his credits. I'm like, this dude's a legend of comedy. I brought up Chris Rock and he's me like, oh man, that's too much of an intro, man.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like,
yeah,
now these people are going to expect something from me.
Drop your expectations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah.
I did the same thing too. And I kept thinking he was like, you know, like in the back watching me going like, man, I'm the reason he does comedy. Fuck, that guy sucks.
That's the same thing I was thinking.
You know what I mean? There's nothing you're going to do that he's going to erase your set immediately, how great he is, you know?
And then there's a couple other, his brother, Tony, brought me up on stage last year. And I was sitting in the back watching him, and he's having a pretty good set. And Tony's, he's a funny comic as well.
Yep.
He's not Chris, but he's
different
funny.
Style.
Yeah, different style.
Yep.
But he got done. He was doing really well. And then he said, who's next? And Jeff said, Rick Ingram.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, for real? He's here? And I'm like, oh, shit. Tony Rock knows who I am. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, man, this dude is so funny, man. He's a favorite here. I'm just like, yeah, he really knows who I am. He's like, give it up for my man, Rick Reagan. I was like, this motherfucker.
Rick Reagan. Oh, my God.
And then Jeff Scott's just losing it, laughing in the microphone over there.
Rick Reagan.
And then I'm like, you know, I wish Honestly, I wish my name was Rick Raygun, because that sounds way cooler than Rick
hilarious.
Ingram. But just so funny. Like, he really sold it to where I'm just like, wow, okay, that's cool. This guy knows who I am. Yeah. He's saying like normal things. You know, wasn't given like the Comedy Central or whatever. It's just
Clubs and colleges all over.
He's like, oh, this guy's a favorite here. I'm like, oh, I think I am a favorite here. This is, oh, he does know. Oh. Rick Raygun. And I just lost it. I walked up there. I was just like, that's so great.
It's wild that, you know, comedy, I describe to people, it's the only business where beginners and intermediates work with the pros.
Yeah.
You don't go see, you know, you don't go see White Stripes and three other bands from the country fair playing with them. And then after White Stripes, maybe you see Led Zeppelin. And then after them, you see like Jimmy.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, ah. And
the kid down the block, they've never played outside their garage before.
Exactly. It's the only biz where the giant stars, I mean, Louis C.K., Chris Rock, all these guys mingle with the beginners.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really, it's funny because I saw Louis on, I listened to him on Howard Stern a couple of weeks ago. If you're a comedian, listen to the interview. It's from May 14th or 15th, and it's incredible. So he said, man, I'm out there in like Bushwick and you know, in Brooklyn and stuff, watching these guys, new guys, and I miss that because they just have no pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just up there like,
say whatever they want.
Yeah. And he's
like, if they get half a laugh, they get off. I'm like, that wasn't too bad.
Exactly. And of course he's the super successful and everything, but you can get it, you know, and it's funny. People always told me when I started, don't skip the process.
Yeah.
Don't try to fucking shoulder rub your way in the back door or whatever. Do the work and enjoy each year as much as you think it sucks ass.
Yeah.
The next year, because I'm on my sixth year now and it seems way harder than your third year, because your sixth year, you're like, well, I'm open for big guys. I'm all over the place, but no agents or managers will touch me.
Right.
And, you know, I'm too old or whatever.
I'm 15 years in and no managers or agents will touch me.
That's what I'm saying. Right. So you're just like, enjoy each year and don't complain and don't try to compare, because as much as everyone says it's true, each one has their own journey.
Yeah.
You know,
I used to be really bad about it. Like, it used to infuriate me every time someone got a break, and I'd be like, I'm funnier than that guy.
Yep.
And it took me a long time to get over that, to where I'm just like,
it's fucking hard.
I'm on a different path.
It's hard.
We're all on our
it
own
really
path
is.
So
it is hard.
And I'm you know, there's been comics who I still don't feel are as funny as me.
Right.
And one, if you don't think you're really funny, you shouldn't be doing this.
Absolutely.
So I understand that I have a warped view of myself in terms of what I expect, and I think I'm funnier than people. But there's people who I think a lot of people would agree aren't as funny as me, but they're considerably better looking than me.
Right.
Oh. And they're a lot, their brand is more sellable than I am.
Right.
And for the
longest
time,
it
infuriated me. And eventually I'm like, that's not, I'm never going to go out for the great looking guy role.
Right.
Like, I've been way better in the last 5 or 6 years, to where it's like when successful things happen for great guys, like when Brent Morin got his show and stuff, like it just made me happy. Where it's just like, that dude is great. He's super nice, deserves it. I've had girls be like, he looks like every good guy. He looks like the good looking guy in every town in America. I'm like, fuck, I should invest in him then, because
it's
going to sell.
Yeah.
But it took me a long time just to fucking be comfortable with me.
Yeah.
To where it's just like, okay, I'll get mine eventually. It's just not going to be the same way. No one's going to be like, whoa, who's Robert Redford up there on stage?
Yeah.
But
I get it. You know, I always try to read things from big comics, and I love Sarah Silverman like immensely. I think she's incredible. And I remember a thing. I read stuff, and it's almost like it plants in my brain as help. As soon as I'm starting to have a breakdown, like, oh, what the fuck, man! It seems like I find something on the internet, and it's like a little piece of brain candy. And one was from her. It said, stop complaining and be undeniable.
Yeah.
And she said, you know what? Nobody wants to hear just the fucking guys in the corner going, fuck that guy and fuck this guy and fuck that. Because you know what? It gets old. Okay, she said that. Another one I heard from a guy was promote what's great, not what you hate. And I really believe in that because I used to just shit on music all the time. I'd be like, fucking Justin Bieber and Britney Spears and fucking Miley Cyrus, you know, burn to the ground.
Right.
And a guy told me something that was so awesome once. He said, you know, promote what's great, not what you hate. And the reason why is the Biebers, the money spills down and the White Stripes guys get to pick a little bit of it up and they get signed.
Right.
Meaning this massive.
They're making a ton of money.
And it spills
down. They can use that money.
There's one
real
guy.
Artists.
There's one guy that has a vision. He goes, what about this band, Rival Sons, over here?
Right.
Meaning, same in comedy. If you don't like a guy's genre, he's still bringing shitloads of people to the club where some people are going to see your stuff and leave walking away. Where if that guy wasn't here, the seats would be empty.
Right.
So it's a machine. And once you realize that Hollywood is a machine, just figure out how to fucking
work
get into the
in.
Machine.
Yeah,
man.
Absolutely. Yeah, Mark Maron actually pulled me aside one night. I was on stage just bitching and complaining about shit. And I got off stage and Maron, I foolishly picked a MySpace fight with Maron.
Yeah.
Just like I saw him say something, I've just started kind of baiting him. And he just started shredding me to pieces. and part of me was like, this is great because Mark Maron knows enough about me that he's picking me apart. And the other part of me is like, wait, what am I doing? I don't want to be destroyed by a master.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I immediately got on there like, oh, no, I was just kidding. Nothing to worry about. so then I was up, a couple weeks later, I was up on the stage and I was just bitching about something. And I got off stage and I was sitting in the back and I was complaining some more to some people and Mark Maron walks up and he taps me on the shoulder and he goes, hey, stop being bitter. No one gives a fuck.
Yep.
And I was just like, and part of me, I'm like, is Maron fucking with me? Because he seems kind of bitter. But then it's like, what he's talking about is true. Like,
well, he knows.
I can complain forever. No one's going to give a shit. No one's going to be like, oh, Rick's not happy. Yeah. He doesn't like these things. We should definitely give him a break then.
Yeah.
It's just like, be you, do you.
That's it.
Fucking.
I learned something from all the guys. It doesn't fucking matter. You know what I mean? It's like, look, dude, there's a million of you out there.
Yeah.
There's a million of you. You know what I mean? And if you make it, it's a million to one.
Yep.
So you know what? Just fucking go do the work and enjoy it.
Yeah.
That's it, man. It sounds corny, like, oh, easy to say. Hey, man, I have dark fucking times.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I'll talk to Mark. Maron to me is exact to the Philip Seymour Hoffman character in Almost Famous.
Yeah.
You call him at late night, like, man, you know, like, you know, just for laughs, they just bring in these open mic guys.
Yeah.
And I'm all over the place. And he's like, doesn't matter, man. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, he's just like that guy. Yeah. You know, of course I'm home. I'm not cool.
We're all not cool, man.
Maron is that guy to me.
That's
and he's
awesome.
My older brother. He's the dad I didn't have around. And he's the good comedy friend. Same with Burr and Ian and stuff. Ian was the guy that told me, man, your shit sucks, dude. You're hacky and you're way funnier in the hall.
That's what Freddie Soto did that for me.
Yeah.
He watched me on, he was like talking about, I'll get my manager to come out and watch you. I was like, oh, cool. And then he watched me. He's like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
He's like, you're endlessly funnier when I talk to you in the parking lot than you are.
That's what he did to me. So then I took me a year. I dumped everything and started over and I was just eating it. But without this is another key phrase. Watch out what you get famous for. Because Ian said, look, you want to get famous with these shitty jokes and then you're just going around America doing shit.
Yeah.
I was like, you're right, dude.
Or you're going to get that opportunity to showcase for that. And you're going to present dumb shit.
Yeah.
And then that's how they're going to remember you forever.
Totally.
The decision makers aren't going to be like, we'll see if he grows. They're going to be like, oh, I saw this guy. He sucks.
They fucking remember like it was yesterday somehow. You're like, what about this guy? Oh, nah, I saw that guy. Yeah, but that was in 82. Doesn't matter. He sucked in 82.
Trust me, he's not good.
Everyone sucked when they started. Doesn't matter. He wanted a showcase too soon.
Yep.
He pays the price.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's why I don't showcase.
Yeah.
Everybody goes, hey, you showcasing for this or that? Nah, I'm just doing comedy, man.
Right.
That's all I'm fucking doing.
Yeah.
You know? Thanks for having me, dude.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for coming by. You have several podcasts, don't you?
I have the one podcast, but I do two versions of it. It's called Let There Be Talk. So on Monday, I drop, which check it out. Rick Ingram did an episode, and it's incredible. His journey is awesome, and I love the guy and have nothing but the biggest respect for him. So please follow him, because I know people are going to be listening to this that follow me.
Right. So it's Let There Be Talk.
Let There Be Talk.
iTunes. Okay.
And then on Thursday, I drop a live version where I take calls, and that's called Bitchin' on Let There Be Talk. Because I was getting too many emails. I answer all the emails personally.
Right.
But it's just like, oh, I come home at night. I'm like, I feel bad if I don't return them. And there's fucking hundreds, you know? So I'm like, just call me.
Right.
So now people call in and it's fucking badass. And I dropped that on Thursdays.
Nice. All right. And then,
and I'll have you come do the call in one. Cause I have guest hosts and stuff.
Be sweet.
It's badass.
And you're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter, Dean Del Rey. And also, I'm going to be this is coming out this week. So I'll be on the road with Mark Maron in July.
Okay.
And, I'm headlining the Denver Comedy Works. That's the main gig I want to pump June 30th through July 3rd, because it's one of the most prestigious clubs in America.
Yeah.
Denver Comedy.
Legendary.
Works. Yeah. It's so fucking good.
People talk raves about it. So yeah, go check them out.
Dude, thank you.
All the listeners in Colorado, definitely go out and see Dean when he's there. What were the dates?
June 30th through July 3rd. It's the 4th of July weekend.
Perfect. Get some all-American comedy with Mr. Dean Del Rey.
Yeah, light the candles. Dude, thank you so much.
Thanks for being on, man.
I love this place and I love you, man.
Comedy Store, come check it out. Follow Comedy Store on Twitter, Facebook.
Periscope.
They're periscoping now. They're probably still vining. I'm not sure. But come out. If you're in LA, come see a show. If you live here, come regularly. It's a fun place. 8433 Sunset. It's right in the heart of Sunset Boulevard. So come check it out. And thanks for listening, guys.
Also, if you're a tourist and you're coming, come every Monday. It's free for the potluck.
True.
Every Monday is free, and you will see some of the most insanity you've ever seen.
Very true. Characters in every corner. So
yeah.
And there's a lot of corners here. thanks, guys, for listening. It's Comedy Store Podcast. My guest today was Dean Del Rey, and thanks for coming, man.
Thank you, dude. I love you, man.
Peace.